When you hear the word hip-hop, what rappers do you picture? Are they Asian American? Our next guest made a film that looks at the Asian American hip-hop scene and the struggles surrounding making music in a genre that's historically rooted in black culture. The film is called Bad Rap. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Out of 100 rappers, there's like 5 Asian American rappers.
There aren't many Asian rappers doing it.
You'll hear Asian rappers that sound Asian.
What's this whole business about sounding black?
Dude, it's so frustrating. Awkwafina has a booking agent. I've been trying to do that for like the last 5 years.
A cute Asian girl who has like catchy hipster songs, like you know how to sell that.
It's like the hip hop elitists that want to tear me down because like they're not used to seeing a little diminutive Asian girl.
There's nothing better than being underestimated.
You never see an Asian that's really being innovative ever complain about how unfair it is.
We're joined now by Jakey Cho and Salima Karoma. They're the co-producers of Bad Rap. The documentary follows the careers of 4 Asian American rappers as they try to break into a music industry that often views them as outsiders. It's playing tomorrow in Madison as part of the Madison Asian American Media Spotlight. Jakey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Salima, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's talk first about how the idea came about to make this film about Asian American rappers. Jakey, do you want to start us off with that?
Growing up as an Asian American who is infatuated with hip hop, always wanted to figure out some sort of a way to document the story about Asian Americans that participated or that are currently active in the hip hop music genre. So I had this idea circulating in my head for many years, and one day during my tenure as a online editor for a hip-hop magazine called XXL, I received an email from Salima, who at the time was a grad student at Columbia studying documentary filmmaking. She wanted to work on a project, and we met, we discussed, chatted up, and I kind of suggested the idea of doing something about Asian Americans in hip-hop. Then Salima kind of took the ball, and she just quarterbacked the situation. We found our 4 characters that we felt that could lead the film and tell a very strong story and a narrative. And 3.5, Salima, would you say? 3.5 years later.
Yeah, about 3.5, 4 years.
Yeah.
Well, Salima, take the ball.
3.5 years later, we're here.
You took the ball and ran with it with this idea in hand. How did you start trying to work with Jakey on putting this idea together?
One of the things is Jakey and I are really big hip-hop fans. You know, we both were hip-hop writers. And, you know, the idea of hip-hop and how gender plays out and race plays out and age and sexuality and how it all plays out in hip-hop for both of us is very interesting. And, you know, doing a story about Asian Americans in hip-hop is something that, you know, we haven't really seen people do before, right? So, you know, you have this whole generation of Asian Americans who've grown up here, who listen to hip-hop, who are involved in hip-hop culture, and not even just this generation, but generations past who were part of, you know, the emergence of hip-hop that nobody ever talks about. And, you know, we just thought that that was so important to tell that story and to give a voice to that. You know, and we were able to do that, and a lot of the people we talked to, we had access to because they'd never been able to tell this story. So, you know, everything just came together very well for Bad Rap.
One thing that struck me hearing some of the rappers talk, they didn't necessarily want to define themselves or think of themselves as Asian American rappers or whatever their background, Chinese American rappers, but coming into the world of hip-hop and rap, that's what almost everyone else, that was kind of the shorthand when people looked at them. How did they talk about that? How do they feel about that, Jakey?
The reality is Asian Americans constitute a small population in America, and the artists are going to continuously have to carry that banner that they are Asian American rappers. However, visibility and continuous approach in their music is going to eventually make them something that that everybody could pretty much appreciate. So I think the artists themselves, they understand that, and they embrace the fact that they are Asian Americans. However, the fact that, you know, they just don't want to be pigeonholed into that one particular category, but they do understand it, and then they embrace it for what it is.
Right, Salima, it seems like they want to be taken on their own terms, not as, you know, a novelty, because they're different than the other rappers people might think about.
Absolutely. A lot of times, you know, when I would tell people that I was, you know, making the film, people would ask me, well, you know, what's Asian rap, right? What's Asian rap? And that's a great question. What is Asian rap? That doesn't exist, you know? So it's like you have these four characters who are totally different, who have totally different styles of the way that they their images and their rap. And, you know, you couldn't say any of them does Asian rap, right? Because that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, I think one of the struggles that they've had to deal with is, you know, being creative and wanting to create great music, but also always having that that prefix of Asian rapper. And I think, you know, to some extent, they do want to reach beyond that.
Well, the incredible amount of diversity I saw. I mean, one of the rappers you feature came via, I think it was Argentina. There are people with different national origins, different amounts of generations since immigration happened. It makes it hard to say this is what Asian American identity is, I guess, overall, but Asian American rap is.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if anything, they're Americans. All the artists, except for one who came to America when he was 1 year old, they were all born and raised in America in different parts of America. One is from Queens, one is from Virginia, one grew up in Los Angeles. So if anything, their identity, definitely the underlying identity, the fact that they're of Asian descent connects them, but what is even beyond that is that they're deeply connected in their regional roots. You know, having somebody from the West Coast is significantly different from having somebody who grew up in the East Coast.
Right.
So, and their music is also reflective of that as well.
Mm.
But as just kind of going back to the point that I made, the fact that they are of Asian descent and the public or the media or even Asian American community accepting them or labeling it as that, it poses as a challenge, but at the same time, for a lot of these artists, they embrace it for what it is as well.
We're talking to the creators of the documentary Bad Rap, telling the story, focusing in mainly on four Asian American rappers. It's airing in Wisconsin. Salima, let's meet the rappers a little bit. Can you give us a taste of who they are and what they do, the four people you feature?
Right. So we do talk to a lot of different artists and people in the background and academics in the film, but the story revolves around four main artists: Dumbfounded, Awkwafina, Rex Dizzy, and Lyrix. So, you know, each of them, they're all friends, and each of them is at a different point in their careers. You know, some are, I guess, bigger than others. So Dumbfounded, who at the time that we started this was probably the biggest artist out of the four, you know, we followed his story a lot, and he really tied everybody else together. Then you have Awkwafina, from New York, who is, you know, this amazing, you know, she produces and she raps, but she also, you know, is thinking, you know, has to think about this, the gender and all these other intersectional questions. And then, you know, you have Rex Dizzy and Lyrix, who they each have their own style, and all of them are dealing with different issues, whether it's, you know, parents and expectations from parents and image and creativity and what you can say as an Asian rapper and what you can't say.
And, of course, you've both written about rap and hip-hop. Jakey, tell us about these four as performers. Tell us a little about their music. Are they good?
I would say they are actually amazing. My personal favorite from a technical perspective is this character named Lyrix.
I didn't know that.
From yeah, I mean, just from a technical perspective, I feel like he follows the traditional, the quote-unquote traditional hip-hop sound, enunciating your lyrics very clearly. And he just, as a rapper, he delivers it very strongly, and I think he could sit or stand side to side to some of the best in the industry right now. But from a from a characteristic perspective, if we're talking about characters, my favorite would be Rex Stizzy. He's hilarious. he has a very loud character, loud, boisterous, and in some ways, very belligerent character. And as a person watching this guy, it's entertainment in itself. And in terms of Awkwafina, she, as Salima mentioned, she's a well-rounded, very smart, very articulate, but in some ways could also be wild as well. If anything, out of the four characters, she's taken beyond just rap music. She was recently casted as one of the eight characters who will be playing the revamped version of Ocean's 11, Ocean's 8, starring an all-female cast. And last but not least, Dumbfounded, he embodies workmanship, because this guy, he's been rapping from the freestyle circuit to the battle circuit to transitioning that into a very thriving YouTube millennial-targeted circuit. And now he's also rediscovering how he could utilize his music to reach the growing Asian market in Asia.
And Salima,
Rob, I don't know if you're also asking, is it any good, right? Uh-huh. And I think that's one of the questions that I ask in every interview is, are Asian rappers good, right? So you talk about hip-hop and what hip-hop is and the roots of it. It comes from, you know, it's rooted in black culture, right? Mm-hmm. So for other people to break in, so say a Big Pun or an Eminem, they are generally just really, really, really above and beyond good.
Right.
So
right,
you can't just right. to be an Asian rapper to break into the mainstream, you can't just be good. You have to be great, and there has to be something other than your Asian-ness that people are going to be attracted to. So, you know, that's sort of something that they always have to think about, and they know they can't just be good, they have to be great.
Well, I wanted to ask some of the rappers talked about stereotypes of Asian Americans. They mentioned things like the myth of the model minority, well behaved. One was talking about being treated as weak, passive. It seems like there's nothing more opposite that than being out there in the hip hop and rap world. Salima, can you talk about that?
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons why I thought, you know, J.K. and I thought this would be such an interesting topic to explore, because what is hip-hop stereotypically is it is, you know, hard or aggressive, confrontational, right? And what, you know, Asian men specifically, what they've been stereotyped here in the U.S. is to be docile. It's the antithesis of hip-hop, docile, non-confrontational, not sexy, right? So, you know, how do you become an Asian rapper in the mainstream if your very sort of like existence is stereotypically the antithesis of hip hop? How do you do that? So this is what we're trying to explore in Bad Rap.
We'll have to leave it there. Salima, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And J.K., you're bringing the documentary to Wisconsin. Have a good visit.
Thank you so much for your time, and I will have a good visit. Thank you.
That's J.K. Cho and Salima Karoma, co-producers of Bad Rap, a documentary film about the Asian American hip-hop scene. J.K. will be hosting a Q&A session tomorrow night with a showing at the Elvium Building on the UW-Madison campus as part of the Madison Asian American Media Spotlight.
The world is still a big place. It's estimated that up to 7,000 different languages are spoken around the world, and some languages spoken more often than others.
But what if there was a common tongue that everybody could speak? A second, easy-to-learn language that could bridge those divides? That was the idea behind Esperanto, the universal language that didn't quite catch on globally, but still exists to this day. Born in the late 19th century, Esperanto was built from scratch on the idea that it could unite the world and help humans understand each other.
In a new book, our guest takes an in-depth look at the language, its creator, and the utopian vision behind Esperanto. Esther Shore is a professor of English at Princeton University and the author of Bridge of Words, Esperanto and the Dream of a Universal Language. Esther, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Saluton.
Well, Esther, I'm guessing that was the very first taste of Esperanto from you. And since you kind of tantalized me there, can you just speak a line or two of Esperanto?
Of course. Ĉiuj demandas al mi kiel Esperanto sonas. Tio dependas de kiu parolas. What I just said is everyone asks me how Esperanto sounds, and it depends on who's speaking.
Interesting.
A French person will sound like they're speaking French. A Japanese person will sound like they're speaking Japanese, etc.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly flexible language, it turns out, and we'll get to that. And Esther, what is it that first drew you to the language?
I think I'm one of those language freaks. I've always been very interested in words and etymologies and languages. I was not an Esperantist when I started writing this book. So, you know, while I would like my book to not to get people to speak Esperanto, but to get people to listen to Esperanto, I have to be honest and say that isn't the reason why I wrote this book. I think books get written sometimes for mysterious and wayward reasons. I had just finished writing a biography of Emma Lazarus, who was a Jew who was thinking outside the box in the 1880s, and it seemed like a very interesting time period, and I started thinking about other possible subjects, and Zamenhof, the creator of Esperanto, caught my attention. So I thought I would write a book about him, but once I started learning the language, which I did in an immersive three-week program in California, I realized, wow, this is quite a phenomenon about which I had known nothing and about which most North Americans know nothing. And I thought, what I really need to do is write a biography of this people.
Well, and it started with, as you mentioned, Ludwig Lazarus Zamenhof. Can you tell us a little bit about, I know the book ended up not being just about him, but you do tell his story. What led him to set out to create a language that he hoped everyone would end up learning?
Was a person who had ideals about human beings. He also was a Jew living in multicultural Bialystok, a place that he called a babble of languages. And he understood that language brought people together, and it was a bond among people. He spoke Hebrew and Yiddish and Russian, as well as several other languages. So he understood that very well. And he understood the warmth that speaking a language brings out in people. But he also felt that language was a barrier. And as he put it, he saw himself throwing down a plank over the river between peoples to try to find a common footing for them to speak to one another. So that was his idea behind Esperanto. There's also a Jewish story here, which is an important part of my book, because Zamenhof had an ethical monotheism, a kind of religion, if you will, that he thought Esperanto would go along with Esperanto, and he called it Hillelism after a first century Jewish rabbi. And the story of how Hillelism and Esperanto parted ways has to do with its history in France during the Dreyfus era, and anti-Semitism really led to Zamenhof agreeing to put aside Hillelism so that Esperanto could have a fair chance in France, which it did.
Could you tell us something about how you go about creating a language? Because, I mean, I know that J.R.R. Tolkien did it in some books, but not one that people speak, you know, really in the day-to-day world, when this is a language that is still alive in some pockets today. So how did he do that?
Well, he was not a professional linguist, although his father and grandfather were language teachers. He was a physician. He was an ophthalmologist by training, and he had a pile of dictionaries. He had no internet to help him do corpus studies about what words are used more than other words. And he based it on Romance languages, and he took lexemes, he took parts of words from Romance languages, and he decided he would have a language of roots, not of words. And these roots would be utterly flexible, and by taking a different ending, a different vowel ending, they would immediately become different parts of speech. And the other ingredient was affixes, that is, prefixes and suffixes. And you could then combine roots, affixes, with more affixes and more roots, and put a language together. And that is what the Esperantists have done.
So you've taken classes in this. I mean, does this work as a language, this thing that this guy invented? Can humans communicate as well in Esperanto as they would in English, Japanese, Swahili, you name it?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, because the answer is yes, absolutely. It's a living language. Every summer, for example, about 2,000 fluent speakers of Esperanto have a congress somewhere in the world, and they spend the entire week speaking it. It's lasted longer than almost any other, I would say, than any other invented language, and it has a community in 6 continents, 70 countries, of many, many kinds of people. So, you know, to change the conversation on Esperanto, I guess I'd have to say I think it's been a success and not a failure.
Why do you think people want to speak it? I mean, what did you talk to a lot of people who are Esperanto speakers and enthusiasts in a way? What did they tell you?
Well, there are a lot of different things that bring people to Esperanto, and it's hard to generalize, but I will tell you that there's a pleasure principle of Esperanto that is immediately apparent if you enter an Esperanto gathering. People do it because they want to do it. They choose it. It's not on anybody's to-do list. It's not a requirement for a job. It's not something on a parent's list of things to do today. It's something you choose for pleasure, and there are a lot of different kinds of pleasure people get out of it. Some people get pleasures simply from socializing with people who are very different from themselves. Some people have satisfaction in the more idealistic parts of Esperanto, which is that it's an egalitarian language, radically egalitarian. If it's a language that's not backed by armies or commerce, it's simply backed by human choice and a will to connect with other people.
Were there particular cultures, groups, political movements that really embraced Esperanto maybe more than others?
Yes. You know, it began in the Russian Empire, so I think the earliest users were concentrated there. The next largest group of people were French, and the French people who adopted it were really sort of intellectuals and academics, so it gained a lot of prestige. But the political movement that embraced Esperanto was the left in the 1920s, and there was a split in the Esperanto world between the neutral Esperantists and the a-nationalist Esperantists. They were a mix of anarchists and socialists and syndicalists, and they're the ones who really grew Esperanto at an amazing clip. They dwarfed the neutral sector by a factor of 3, and that in a way was the great flowering of Esperanto in the world. And it's been associated with the left, I would say, ever since, although, you know, there are people of many, many political, you know, persuasions who do it. I would say most people are moderate to left who do it.
It sounds like today it's also something, you know, that binds people together. You write about, for instance, almost a like an Airbnb network of Esperanto speakers, that if you can speak this language, you might have something in common with people all around the world.
Well, it's a delightful thing called Pasporta Servo, which means a passport service. It's just a directory of Esperantists who say, you know, I would be happy to take in an Esperantist for up to 3 nights free of charge. And people travel all over the world this way with great pleasure. You know, I think what Zamenhof understood was that people didn't need a common heritage to bond together in a committed, passionate, warm way, that what they needed was a shared future. And in order to make people commit to a shared future together, he gave them the language. This, to me, was the most heroic thing one could possibly do, and he did it. Right from the get-go, he said, this language belongs to its users. I do not own it. I do not determine its future. You will grow it, and you will use it. And, you know, it's nobody's mother tongue, and it's not a fatherland, but it's like a child for the Esperantic community. They have grown this language and created it themselves.
It seems like a big obstacle in the spread of Esperanto was timing. The 1930s, an era of nationalism, anti-Semitism, you mentioned being an issue earlier. Was and a backlash against anarchism and things of the left, was that part of what turned maybe a lot of people against the idea of Esperanto?
Yeah, I mean, Esperanto has a way, a phoenix-like way of reviving and recouping and reconstituting itself after various disasters. Clearly, the 30s and Nazism and Stalinism were an abysmal juncture for the world and certainly for Esperanto. But there's also an interesting chapter of Esperanto in the Soviet Union in the 20s when the Comintern thought, well, Esperantists might be a good way to get our message to workers' groups in the West. So there was a kind of a cooperation between the Esperantists and the Soviets for a while until the Esperantists became a little looser and began being more frank in their reportage, and then the Comintern shut it down.
Esther, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Veronica.
That was Esther Shore, professor of English at Princeton University and the author of the new book, Bridge of Words, Esperanto and the Dream of a Universal Language.